Accession number 16755, reel 3.
Colonel Strangeways, reel 3.
Oh.
You were saying that you had a staff that was concerned with planning for the invasion of Northwest Europe.
Yes.
To whom were you reporting?
A G1 in the War Office. Who was responsible for the briefings for the Chief of Staff.
But this has been part of the joint planning machinery.
No, it wasn't. No. It was a purely War Office thing. But you see, the Chiefs of Staff would meet, and each service would brief on whatever thing was on the agenda that day from their angle. Now, there was, I can't remember this fellow's name. He was a very, very nice man indeed. But during my time at the War Office then, I attended conferences of all natures and got involved. One of my major decisions, things were still going round and round, you know, a file would go round and round and round, people would comment, but nobody would give a decision. And I met by chance an officer who was concerned with railways. And he said, "Oh, I'm frustrated. I can't get any decision from the War Office about the number of flats." That's the word. Number of flats they want. And unless we put the order into the factories, we shan't get them. I must know. So I said, "Well, tell me about flats." He told me about flats. I said, "Thank you very much." And I went away. And I said to Bertie, never forget this. He said, I said to Bertie, "Bertie, get a file to do with the number of flats." He said, what are flats? I said, "Well, things that trains pull along with things on them. There must be a file somewhere about it. Find out where it is and get it sent to us. So we want to edit it." And this file came, and it was about that thick, and everybody had passed the buck round. So I looked at it, and I said, "Bertie, how many flats do we need? Each flat takes roughly so much, so many vehicles, so many tanks." So we talked about it for about a quarter of an hour. I said, "Right, the answer is so many." "That's right. That's where I go. Same thing." So I wrote the thing, sent it back across the road to the AQMG's department, whatever they call it, or used to call it, which is the other side of the road. Tell them to get on and order those flats, which they did, and they were there for D-Day.
Sounds like your role was really one of coordination.
Well, it was coordination. It was coordination and.
Were you part of the military operations staff?
Oh, yes.
So you were one of the MO department?
Oh, yes, I was MO.
Right. So that would have you been there, you'd have been working for the Director of Military Plans.
That's right.
Yes.
We were very... It's something...
Was your office in the old War Office building or in some other...
No, in the War Office building.
Yeah.
Upstairs in the War Office. Oh, yes, very much so.
Did you ever have occasion to go down into the cabinet war rooms under Storey's Gate? Where the Chiefs of Staff had a
meeting? I worked there at one time.
You did?
I later on, I went from the War Office to what? Before D-Day, I don't know how somehow I got there. I was spending most of my time down in the cabinet offices. In fact, I used to work in Churchill's office down there. And I was involved with more than I can, now can see, but by then everything was coming in to what I'd done since I was a subaltern. I could talk to an airman, I could talk to a sailor, and I could talk with reason to the army side. So I forget where I was before D-Day. Oh, I know. Yes. I left the War Office being sent, again, coordination, being sent to Gort in Gibraltar. Or was it Malta? I don't know. He was Malta. Gort in Malta. Before that to Jim, Mason McFarlane. Then Gort. And then Alex. And I had with me the plans for the, not invasion, wrong word, but yes, I suppose it was in a way, of North Africa.
Torch landing.
Yes, right. And I was to take these out, and I was to do certain jobs on the way. Blair's department will brief me. They wanted an answer to this question.
This sounds as though your role was really one of the confidential courier.
That's, yes, it's a good...
Or perhaps the long-range aide-de-camp.
I was going to have to send messages back with advice. When I was with Mason Mack, he was an interesting man. This was in Gibraltar. He had an officer, I think it was his sapper, who was furious with me for having sent a message to the War Office in answer to the question they told me to find out. And I hadn't done it through him.
You hadn't gone through the chain?
No. I said, no. I come from the War Office, and I replied to the War Office. And I'm sorry, but I was a poor little major, you see. It's not regarded as any sort of thing. But they suddenly find he's got a bite. Because his boss is far bigger than they are. He was stupid because I sent back what his own people had given me, and they wanted it prompto, you see. So they got it prompto. Perhaps it had been more, but had I had time, or if I'd known enough of the form, I would have gone to him, sort of kowtowed to him, but he'd got enough on his plate already, I'd have thought. But Mason Mack was marvellous. And from there, flew from there to Jim, to Malta, and there was Gort. And I stayed with Gort.
What did you make of him?
I was very, very sad for him. He was a thunderingly good platoon commander. Now, I don't mean that nastily, but he was on the ground. He did marvels, absolute marvels things in Malta.
Being a thoroughly good platoon commander, even if you're commanding an army, has its virtues.
Well, of course it does. But you see, he went on the ground. I knew Malta, I'd been stationed out there, as I told you. He would go down to the docks when they were unloading and help unload. Some people say this is crazy. It's not crazy. He was identifying with the Maltese. His rations in his palace out, whatever it was called, were the same as everybody else's. And that was that. I don't think, I don't know what would happen if they hadn't had a hemp, somebody like him. But he was not meant to command from the overall point of view. And Malta, of course, is tiny, and he was just the chap for the job.
Could you perhaps say that he was an excellent leader, but not a good commander? He could provide moral inspiration, but he didn't have the...
He didn't got the mind for an overall picture. No, not his fault. He was what he was. But they'd got him in the right place, and that's jolly good.
Was he happy?
No, we had one evening after supper, he said he wanted to talk to me. And he said, what do you think the campaign in the biggest start of the war? So I said, I gave my views. And of course he was involved, totally involved. But it wasn't his scene, he wasn't meant for that. You put somebody in a job, you're responsible for if he's any good for that job. If he's not, you're to blame. No, you can't blame him.
What was his view of what had happened in 1940?
I think he was very sad about it. You see, our commanders had not had the chance ever to command.
Do you think that from what he told you at the time, he regretted any of the major decisions he'd made in 1940?
No. He wanted to get... See, this way he was a very good man. He wanted to hear what a junior officer thought. Now, I have a great principle. The only way of loyalty is to tell the truth. So if you're asked what you think, you tell the person what you think, whether he wants to know it or not. But if he's asked for it, he gets it. And that's the way to be loyal. You cannot be loyal if you give an opinion which is not your genuine opinion, but it's what you think the chap would like to know. That's no good. That's not loyalty. That's I think, deceit of the worst kind. And having been rather critical of Gort mentally, I became a great admirer of him and very sympathetic towards him. He had a difficult life. He did a hell of a job in Malta. Then I went to Cairo. So I went into Alex's domain.
Had you encountered him before?
Yes. But he was commander of the 1st Division at the beginning of the war. I've always liked Alex's straight as a die. He passed me on to see a man called Dudley Clark.
Now, Dudley Clark had been in Norway, hadn't he?
Yes. And Dudley Clark and I got on very well. I mean, personally. And when I'd finished my travels, I went back to the UK, back to the War Office. And I was posted back to the regiment, which was then commanded by, not a duke, by a man whose name I forget, and took over a company. Well, Lisa Agnelli took over the company. And it was incredible. That kit was disgraceful.
In what way was it dirty?
Not dirty. They were just worn out, useless. They were appallingly equipped. Well, I'd just come from the War Office, so I rang up the War Office and said, "Oi, this is going on." And I was meeting with horror, and then they said, "Why? They're going overseas." I said, "Well, they can't do any training if they haven't got the proper equipment." So I pressed the buttons, and I went back to quartermaster and said, "Oi, now look, I'm going to get my company right. And I'm going to chuck out every single thing that's no good. You'll issue the troops with all they should have. Because they don't have it now, they won't know how to use it when they get it." And he was shot off to this commanding officer. I forget his name. The stupid man. But anyhow, I got my way. I did. Had the company lined up, and I used to go through every single thing. And of course, equipment was there, but they were saving it. They were economising.
They're called stores because they're meant to be stored.
Yes.
If they're meant to be issued, they'd be called issues.
Well, the battalion went abroad very shortly after that, and they were properly equipped, and they'd been on exercises. I used to take them out, this poor company out on exercises, bung them through ditches and bung them through rivers and put them all over the flipping place. And I'd come back totally exhausted, but very pleased with themselves. And the quartermaster would get furious at me because they'd ruined some stuff. Well, of course they'd ruined some stuff. That's what you're going to do in war. Let's get used to ruining stuff. And but by then I got shot off.
But when you were commanding this company, were there lots of men in it who you knew?
Oh, yes.
There was the same core of old soldiers.
Yes, they were there. And one man was particularly difficult, who used to be in my hockey team in Malta. I had him up and I said, "No, for goodness sake, stop it. It's time you grew up." And he looked at me with horror and said, I said, "Yes, you're not a young soldier anymore. We all know you're jolly good, so stop it. Or you know it's going to happen, don't you?" He said, "Yes, sir." I said, "All right, don't you dare come back in this office again except something nice." And that was the end of him. He hadn't been stopped before. But he knew me, and I knew him backwards. I said, "We used to play hockey together." And you pick up these things. But I was posted to Pyfors, which meant going through Cairo. I got as far as Cairo. My kit went on to Pyfors, and I was told, "You're going to North Africa." So I said, "Oh, yes. Go and report to Dudley Clark." So I reported to Dudley Clark in his little office, which was in a brothel.
Was that just a matter of security or convenience? Or
no, it was convenience again. It didn't matter. It's a rather good show. He briefed me. Then I saw Terence Airy. That was the chief intelligence officer in those days there. And he briefed me. And I went up to wherever it was in North Africa and opened up my office. I had an officer sent to me and another officer sent to me. And I was, and Alex moved across that, handed over, and he came up. And I became part of his staff, but separate. I was always separate, but he was my, the person to whom I served.
Did you deal with him directly, or?
Oh, yes.
Media,
no, no, no. I had, for normal activities, I dealt with his chief of staff. But I, every day, every time I was in office and I was not out in the operation, I would attend Alex's personal conference with his heads of this, that and the other. And I was there. I never said anything. I listened.
Was this just so that you could get a good overall picture of what was
going
on?
It knew, I had to know exactly what was going on and what was intended. Otherwise, I might make an absolute bosh of things.
And warn the enemy rather than...
Yes, well, you know, make things wrong. You've got to know everything. Now, Alex never spoke to me. He didn't need to speak to me, and I didn't speak. Because all I wanted to know. And it sounds odd, but this is something which the Americans cannot understand. So I knew absolutely everything. And of course, in the end, I got to know all the head administrator and this, that, and the other head signals chap, and they all knew me, and they knew where I was on that level that they were on. They might be major generals or lieutenant generals, but little major me was... And it didn't matter that one was only a major.
Do you remember what Dudley Clark told you when you were first briefed? What did he say to you?
He gave me his first principle of deception. And that is that deception is not to do anything except make the enemy do something that you want him to do. It's not what he thinks, it's what he does. And every plan you write must be for that purpose. What do we want the enemy to do? And your plan goes for that only.
That selection and maintenance of the aim, isn't
it? Yes, it is. And staff office help, staff course helped me immensely. I could write orders. I used to write an appreciation and an order. Had to be short, but you can't take reams of stuff to anybody who's working at a high level. It's got to be short and bonk. And I got jolly good at that, so I say it myself. So I used to... Dick McCrea was the man I really... Dick McCrea and Terence Airy. And, odd enough, Peter de Haven was in that party too. My ex-tutor, whatever you call him, at the Staff College.
How did you react when you were told that your next job was going to be deception? Because you'd been on your way somewhere else, hadn't you?
It doesn't enter your head. You're told whether you've got to go, and you go.
What did you think of it as an occupation? What did you find it, on first impression, an attractive idea? Or?
Oh, yes, I found it an attractive idea. But I don't think... You see, we'd been at war for some time. We were used to going all over the place. It's up to the chaps who send you that you're the right chap. And I had difficulties with some people. We always have difficulties. It was fascinating. We really started doing things there.
In North Africa?
Oh, yes.
Who gave you the big ideas? I mean, did you dream up yourself? Were you sitting there thinking in your own mind about what it was that the enemy should do which would suit our plans?
That's correct. In theory, this was the commander's job. But he's got enough on. So my job was to write very short, when you write your final thing, statement that the enemy, you want the enemy to do so and so, move a division from there to there or whatever it may be, bonk. Now the commander's got to agree that, because if you get that division there and it's the wrong place for the division to be, it might be rather difficult. So he's got to agree it. Now he never did agree it. I never got anything with Addicts at all on this. Dick McCreary would just glance and say, all right, David, on you go. Things are perfectly obvious. If you know everything that your commander's thinking and doing, you, unless you're a perfect prune, you know what he wants the enemy to do. And you don't want the enemy to do something that you feel you can't possibly achieve. That would be crazy. So you, in your appreciation, you've done fact when you got your object, factors in favour, what's in favour of this thing, and what's against it. Now, things in favour you're going to reinforce, things against it you've got to manoeuvre. And that comes clear. And you write your little plan. Now, the plan will demand certain troop activity in those days. And so you used to put down what you wanted to do. You wanted, for example, you might want reconnaissance parties from a division or a corps down so-and-so. Because you make the right kind of traffic for that. And then you send them back. They thoroughly enjoy themselves because it's great fun. And they go back. And the thing slowly develops. I hadn't any troops of my own in those days.
No dedicated forces?
No, nothing at all. You asked for something and you got it.
When you were thinking about what the enemy could be induced to do, did you have any contact with the forward operations enemy syndicate of the joint planners?
Out in the field, there was an out.
But, just pure imagination?
Yes. I had all the facts that I needed, exactly what your commander was wanting to do, was proposing to do, what the state of the game was. You've heard the chief intelligence officer give his summary every morning, you've been there, and to his boss. You've got it. It's all there. And it's only here because you don't want to write anything. You don't want to. The less is written, the better.
When Alex had his morning, did he have a conference every day?
Every day.
Every morning. Prayers.
Morning prayers, yes.
How long would that last?
Sometimes half an hour, sometimes quarter an hour, and sometimes longer.
But it would essentially be an update on the previous days.
Yes. The chief intelligence officer would give his appreciation of the day from the last time he did it. Then the chief of staff would give his troops things. The command would listen. And then Alex would say, so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so. Get up and go.
Then you go back to your own office. Did you give your own orders verbally, or did you ever?
I did. No, I go back to my little tent in those days, and I had my own little team of officers. And if there was something immediate I could tell them, I'd tell them that. Otherwise, I'd go into a huddle by myself, and I had a clerk dictate my things, read it through. Say, right, that's it. get them on to getting stuff, anything we particularly wanted. It usually meant getting into a jeep and going places, going and seeing if a division has got to do something and telling what you want them to do. That's often the difficult part. You meet a...
I was going to ask if you ever encountered resistance to your idea of...